back in Berlin a long time ago. Hurley had become such a problem that he had sent two of his best men to kill him one night. Neither came back. Their bodies were found floating in the Spree River the next day. The day after that, Hurley marched into Ivanov's office in broad daylight and put a gun to his head. Hurley explained the rules to him that morning, rules that Ivanov already knew but had nonetheless ignored. The Americans and Russians were not supposed to kill each other. It was all part of the new détente of the Cold War, the easing tensions in the early 70s brought about by Nixon and Brezhnev. The American then gagged him, blindfolded him, tied him up, and pilfered his files. When Hurley was done, he loosened the ropes on Ivanov's wrists a bit and whispered in his ear, "You should be able to wiggle your way out of these in a few minutes. By then I'll be gone and you'll be faced with two options. You can scream your head off and try to chase me. If you do that, your bosses and everyone else back in Moscow will know that you let an American waltz into your office in the middle of the day, tie you up, and steal your files. You will be an embarrassment to the KGB, and we both know how much the KGB likes to be embarrassed. Your other option? Well, let's just say, I hope you're smart enough to figure it out." Ivanov was smart enough, and he had never told a soul about that day. He coughed into his hand and turned to Syed. "I have heard of this man. What else can you tell me about him?" Syed thought it best to not be too forthright on this point, telling him that the American was the toughest, craziest man he'd ever encountered would not be good for the negotiations. Fortunately, he was saved by the sounds of approaching vehicles. Chapter 64. Hurley dangled in the air from a hook that was tied to his wrists. His toes hovered only a few inches from the floor. His shoulders ached like nothing he had ever experienced. This had been his punishment for taking a bite out of Syed. They also decided to tape his mouth shut, but he thought that had more to do with silencing his insults than with their fear of being bitten. The only nice thing to come of it was that they'd left him alone. Not that hanging by your wrists a few inches off the ground was a nice thing, but it was certainly preferable to having your fingernails ripped out and being electrocuted. There was a noise at the door. A second later it opened, and the light turned on. Hurley blinked a few times before he could see it was Radi. The Fatah leader crossed over and exhaled cigarette smoke into Hurley's face. Hurley inhaled the smoke and thought he might apologize for all the nasty things he'd said about Roddy's mother if only the man would offer him a heater. Roddy reached up and tore the tape off the American's mouth.
"I have a surprise for you."
"We're going to try the rubber hose today?"
"No, something much better."
"Great,"
Hurley said with feigned enthusiasm.
"I can't wait. Hey, about that stuff I said about your mom?"
Before Hurley could get the rest of it out, Roddy smashed his fist into Hurley's stomach.
"I have had enough of your lies. I am going to make you feel more pain than you have ever imagined."
"Good,"
Hurley coughed.
"I hope you kill me, because McNeil will kill you for it. Nothing could make me happier than making sure you went down with me."
"Don't worry, I'm not going to kill you," Roddy said, smiling. "But I am going to kill your son."
Hurley laughed.
"What the fuck are you talking about?"
Roddy turned to his men. "Get him."
"My son?"
Hurley asked.
"You must be off your rocker, unless you mean one of your bastard brothers I fathered with your mother."
"Yes, keep talking. We will see how tough you are in a moment."
The two men returned, each with one arm looped under Rapp's armpits. Rapp was shuffling along, trying to keep up and blabbing incessantly about the money he could get them. Rapp saw Hurley and yelled,
"Dad, don't worry, we're going to get out of this. Washington is going to pay for your release."
Hurley looked at Rapp and said,
"What the fuck are you talking about? Have you lost your mind?"
Roddy was finally having some fun. "This is beautiful. You are right. I can't kill you, but I can kill your son. A big American fuck you."
Roddy snapped his fingers and pointed at the floor.
"Bring him here."
The men dumped Rapp on the ground at Roddy's feet.
"I will handle him," he said, as he drew the American's silenced Beretta from his waistband. "Hold the father's head and make sure his eyes are open."
The two men left Rapp and took up positions on the right and left side of Hurley. They grabbed his head and dug their thumbs into the skin just under his eyebrows and pulled up.
"Make him look,"
Roddy commanded as he grabbed a fistful of Rapp's hair.
"Over here."
"Why are you doing this?"
Rapp wailed in a panicked voice.
"Our government will pay you."
Ari bent over and said, "They will pay for him, you idiot. You are worthless." He straightened and looked at Hurley. "Are there any other lies you'd like to spew about my mother?" Hurley didn't offer a reply. "How does a man of your considerable, though twisted talents, sire such a stupid child?" Rapp looked up, only half listening to the insults. His focus was on a beautiful 9mm suppressed Beretta. Roddy kept waving the gun back and forth, sticking it in Hurley's face, and then pointing it at Rapp's head. Rapp followed it like a tennis volley. Roddy's finger was on the trigger, and the red dot above his thumb told Rapp that the safety was off and the gun was hot. The man settled into a rhythm with his insults. He was now saying something about Rapp's mother, the woman he presumed to have slept with Hurley. The Palestinian stuck the tip of the suppressor under Hurley's nose and ordered him to beg for his son's life. As Hurley started to speak, the gun began its slow-motion arc back to Rapp. Rapp made his move. He sawed most of the way through the tape around his wrists while he was back in the holding cell. Now, not sure the tape would break, he went for a two-handed grab around the barrel of the gun, his hands clamped down on the steel while the gun was still swinging Rapp's way. Rapp stood, driving the gun straight up so a misfire wouldn't bury itself in Hurley's chest. At the top, he pivoted to his left, bringing the gun up and over the top of his head before pulling it back down on the other side, effectively putting Roddy in an armbar. In this position, the Palestinian couldn't move unless he let go of the gun. Rapp delivered a quick knee strike to Roddy's face, and a bullet spat harmlessly into the cinderblock wall. Having dazed him, Rapp ripped the gun free. He swung the pistol back, cracking Roddy across the forehead with the heavy metal grip. The blow sent him to the floor. Rapp tried to wrench his wrists free of the remaining duct tape, but it caught. The other two men were finally starting to move. Hurley, realizing that one of the men might yell for help, started screaming at the top of his lungs as if he were being beaten. Rapp took a step back to get a better angle and yanked again, but the last bit of tape held, so he flipped the gun up in the air and caught the grip with both hands. The man on his left was no more than 4 feet away when he fired the gun twice, hitting him both times in the chest. The man collapsed at Rapp's feet. Rapp swung the gun around on the other man, who was caught between the door and Hurley. He was never going to make it, so he stopped and put his hands up in the air. "Shoot him!" Hurley ordered in a raspy voice. Rapp squeezed the trigger and buried a bullet in the man's forehead. "Get me down! Quick!" Hurley hissed. "What about him?" Rapp asked, pointing the gun at Roddy, who was showing signs of life. "Get me down first!" Rapp ripped through the last bit of tape while he ran over to the wall and untied the makeshift pulley. Hurley dropped the short distance to the floor, landing on his feet. He wavered for a second and then caught his balance. "Give me that gun," Hurley ordered, "and check the right thigh pocket of that second one you shot. He should have a knife." Rapp placed the gun in Hurley's hands and went off to search for the knife. Hurley walked over to Roddy, whose arms were starting to flop around as if he was waking up from a deep sleep. Hurley stomped on his stomach, and the Palestinian's eyes popped open. Hurley bent over and pressed the suppressor against Roddy's chest. Looking into his eyes, he said, "You should have killed me when you had the chance, you piece of shit." Hurley pulled the trigger. Chapter 65. Two of the sedans pulled into the hangar, and three more stopped just outside. All of the doors opened at roughly the same time, and a dozen well-armed men fanned out, creating a barrier at the door, effectively sealing Ivanov off from his Spetsnaz escort. Ivanov looked at the commander with extreme disappointment. Mognia approached with a confident grin on his face. Four of his bodyguards trailed a few paces back.
"Mikhail, welcome to Beirut."
"I would hardly call this a welcome."
"You will have to excuse all of this, but I am not in a good mood today."
"And why is that?"
"Because I just found out that you have been scheming behind my back yet again."
"What are you talking about?"
"You will notice that our Iraqi and Iranian friends are not here."
"Why?"
Syed asked, alarmed by the news.
"Because I found out that Mikhail had made a deal with them. Didn't you, Mikhail?"
Ivanov tried to laugh the question away as if it was a harmless maneuver. Mognia turned his attention back to Syed and said,
"He set the ceiling at 5 million. The others are going to bow out and let him win."
"What did you do with him?" Syed asked.
"For the moment they are my guests. I will decide if I am going to kill them later."
Ivanov clasped his hands together and laughed. Mognia was proving to be much smarter than he had given him credit for.
"You have outsmarted me, Imad. That does not happen very often. Would you like me to leave, or would you like to discuss business? Negotiate some terms, perhaps?"
"I will negotiate nothing with you. I am going to name a price, and you are going to pay it."
"Really?"
Ivanov said. And what if I decide I don't like your price?
Then we will have a big problem.
Ivanov nodded, as if he found the game amusing.
Before we get to that, though, I need you to return all of the money you took from our Swiss bank accounts.
Money that I took?
Ivanov's eyes nearly bulged out of his head. I did no such thing.
I think you did.
As a matter of fact, I want my money back from you.
Your money?
Yes, my money.
Ivanov's face was blazing red.
The money that you took. You don't think I suspected you at once? You never liked Sheriff. You did nothing but complain about his prices. You called him a rat and a traitor to the cause for charging his inflated prices.
I did not kill Sheriff,
Mugnia denied flatly.
And why should I believe you?
Because I am a man of honor. Someone who fights for what he believes in, not a thief like you.
Honor? This is beautiful. You, of all people, speak of honor. Imad Mugnia, the hijacker of civilian airliners, the kidnapper of professors, the man who shells entire neighborhoods filled with women and children. You speak of honor. That is laughable.
Ivanov literally spat the last word at his accuser. Mugnia reached for his gun, but the Svetsnaz commander beat him to the draw and pointed the barrel of his Markov pistol at the side of Mugnia's head. All of a sudden it appeared as if everyone had a gun. Slides were being racked and hammers cocked.
Enough! Syed shouted. Your disdain for each other has blinded your judgment. And you are a fool!
Mugnia yelled. Syed approached him and in a voice loud enough for only Mugnia to hear said,
And you are broke. How are you going to pay all of your men next week and the week after that?
Get control of your hot temper and let me handle this.
Speaking to the group, he then said, Everyone, lower your weapons! He motioned with his hands and repeated himself two more times until finally all of the weapons were either holstered or pointed in a safe direction.
I know that Imad did not steal the money, and I do not think that Mikhail did so either.
How can you know?
Mugnia angrily asked.
Tell me, why would he come here today if he had stolen our money?
While Mugnia pondered that question, Svets stepped forward.
I can assure you that my boss had nothing to do with the stolen funds. I visited Herr Dorfman's boss in Hamburg last week. More than $50 million was stolen. It appears we were not the only targets.
Svets wanted to get out of here with his life, so he quickly added,
We are following several leads, including one that the money was stolen by an organized crime element out of Prague.
And I can promise you, Ivanov added quickly, that when we find these people, we will get our money back and we will punish the people who took it.
Thank you, Syed said. Right now we have something very important to negotiate. We have three Americans, John Cummins, who served 4 years in Moscow and the last four in Damascus, another relatively young man by the name of Robert Richards, and the infamous Bill Sherman. Syed grabbed the file off the table and handed it to Ivanov, giving him a second to study the photo again. Now, how much would your government be willing to pay for these three men? Ivanov unconsciously licked his lips. A prize like Stan Hurley would virtually guarantee him the directorship. Primakov was getting old and lacked the ruthless animal instinct that it took to run the SVR. He could control the interrogation and filter what information he passed on. The thought of keeping that asshole Hurley in the basement of one of his secure sites like some exotic animal was almost too much to take. He reminded himself that this was still a negotiation and his funds were not unlimited.
I am confident that my government would pay $5 million for these three.
That is not enough,
Mugnia complained before anyone had had a chance to absorb the offer. Thus started the back and forth, with Ivanov coming up $3 million in his price. They were stuck there for a few minutes, while Mugnia kept saying that he would only accept an offer of $16 million. Ivanov, as well as Syed, tried to explain to him that the issues of the stolen money and the value of the American spies had nothing to do with each other. Ivanov raised his offer to $10 million and was prepared to walk away when Mugnia finally counted at $14 million. 30 seconds later they had agreed on $12 million, and everyone breathed a sigh of relief. No one more so than Syed. They were only halfway done, though. Mugnia wanted all the money in their possession before they would turn the men over, and Ivanov wasn't going to release a red cent until he laid eyes on Stan Hurley. Syed broke the stalemate by saying,
You need to call Moscow, correct?
Yes.
Why don't I retrieve the prisoners? They are not far from here. You can make the arrangements to have the money transferred, and when we get back, we can complete the transaction.
Ivanov who wanted to get as far away from this horrible place and these horrible people as quickly as possible, leaped at the chance to expedite his departure.
"That is a wonderful idea."
Turning to Schwetz, he said, "Nikolai, go with SF and bring the prisoners back here." The last thing Schwetz wanted to do was leave the relative security of this hangar and drive into downtown Beirut. He considered asking if he could bring a few of the Spetsnaz with him, but he knew the request would be denied. As he followed Syed and his men to their car, he wondered how much longer he could continue to work for Ivanov. Chapter 66. Rapp found the knife, dug it out of the man's pants, and crossed the room. He took his gun back from Hurley and stuck it under his armpit while he cut the tape from Hurley's wrists. The tape peeled free, and Hurley said, "Give me the gun." Rapp held out the knife. "Get your own." Hurley grumbled and took the knife. "There are two guys in the hallway." Rapp started dragging one of the bodies across the room and placed it by the wall with the door. "I'll open the door. You try to sound like Roddy. Yell for them to get in here and I'll pop them." When the bodies were piled out of sight, Rapp placed his hand on the door handle. Hurley stood behind him. Rapp nodded and yanked the door open. Hurley muttered something about a mess and ordered the two guards to get in there. Unfortunately, only one appeared. Rapp shot him in the back of the head while pulling the door open farther and swinging his left arm around, searching for the second man. The tip of the suppressor ended up less than a foot from the man's face. Rapp squeezed the trigger and shot him in the nose, pink mist exploding out into the hallway. Stepping over the body, he looked left and right. The hallway was empty. Rapp dragged the guard into the room. Hurley was already stripping the first guard of his pants, shirt, and boots. Rapp did the same with the second guard and told Hurley to grab the man's bandana. When Rapp found the radio, he asked Hurley, "Do you know where we are?"
"No."
"I think I might. What about Bobby and Cummins?"
"Bobby should be here, but I think they took Cummins to the airport. They're trying to auction off our asses."
"We'll get Bobby in a second, but I need to call Ridley first." Rapp dialed in the right frequency and hit the transmit button. All he got was static.
"Bad reception down here," Hurley told him. "We'll have to get out of the basement."
"All right." Rapp looked around the room. "I assume Bobby is naked, too?"
"Yeah, let's grab him some clothes."
Rapp scavenged up a set while Hurley collected two ammo pouches with 8 extra AK-47 magazines. When they had everything, they tied the bandanas around their faces, and Rapp checked the hallway. It was still empty, so they ducked out, closing the door behind them and locking it. The next door over was padlocked, so Rapp shot the lock off with his Beretta. Hurley opened the door and froze. There, dangling from the hook in the middle of the room, with a rope wrapped around his neck, was Richards.
"Motherfuckers,"
was all Hurley could manage to say. Rapp considered checking for a pulse, but Richards' skin was chalk white. He'd been dead for hours.
"Should we bring him with us?"
"No." Hurley shook his head. Rapp closed the door to Richards' cell and told himself he would process it later. They ran down the back hallway, but when they got near the stairs, they heard some voices. Hurley started making hand gestures, but Rapp waved him off, putting him back away from the stairs. Whispering in his ear, Rapp said, "I have an idea." Rapp handed him the two-way radio. "Try Ridley again. Tell him I think we're at Martyrs Square. I'm going to run down to the front of the building and see if I can start a little something." Rapp started to move, but Hurley grabbed him.
"What are you talking about?"
"Just wait here. If I'm right, you're going to hear a shitload of gunfire in about a half minute. Then we'll make our break." Rapp pointed at the radio. "Just try to raise Ridley. I'll be right back." Rapp tore off down the hallway, slowing when he was 15 feet from the stairs at the front of the building. He stopped and listened for a moment, but heard nothing. Then there was the sound of a foot scraping along the floor and a faint voice. Rapp couldn't tell if it was coming from the first floor or farther up. He considered going back to Hurley. He could use his silenced Beretta to take out whoever was at the back of the building and then try to make a run for it. Fundamentally, though, there was a problem. They were on the wrong side of town and severely outgunned. They needed a diversion to get out of here. "Full speed ahead," he muttered to himself as he started up the stairs, his silenced pistol in his left hand and the AK-47 in the right. Midway up the steps, he got his first glimpse of a small lobby off to the left, maybe 15 by 15 feet. Rapp counted two heads and then three. The main entrance was sandbagged, as were the windows on each side, although they'd left two holes in the sandbags to fire from, exactly what Rapp was looking for. When he hit the landing, he noticed two more men lying on the floor. One was standing, looking out one hole in the sandbags, watching the street, and two more were sitting in folding chairs, playing a board game. Rapp walked straight for the man who was on his feet. He kept his pace casual and started shaking his head as if he was going to tell them just how crappy things were downstairs. One of the men started bitching in Arabic. The best Rapp could figure was that the man was telling him he had another hour before he had to pull a watch in the toilet. Rapp laughed and then raised the suppressed Beretta. He had had 18 shots to start with and was down to 12. The guy who was standing got it first, a nice little shot from 10 feet right in the left eye. The two guys playing the board game, one got it in the back of the head and the other in his open mouth. Rapp never stopped moving. It was another nice thing Hurley had taught him. When you have the advantage, close with the enemy. He was no more than 8 feet away when he shot the two nappers. The first one was clean, but with the second guy, he was off a bit on the first shot, so he had to fire one more to put him out of his misery. 6 shots left. Rapp glanced to his left. The hallway had been barricaded with scraps of broken office furniture. The stairs going up were empty. He walked over to the little 1x1 foot hole in the sandbags and looked across the street. Sure enough, about 200 feet away was a similar building. This had to be Martyrs Square. Rapp slung his AK-47 over his right shoulder, stuffed the Beretta in his waistband, and picked up the dead lookout's AK-47. He gripped the rifle firmly, flipped the selector switch to full automatic, and sighted at the building across the street. He didn't want to kill anyone over there, but he did want to make sure he got their attention, so he chose a position on the second floor and let it rip. The bullets shredded the afternoon calm, thudding into the sandbags across the street and then the building itself as it climbed. Rapp emptied the entire magazine and dropped the weapon. Without hesitating, he moved to the people on the other side of the front door and took aim with the other AK-47. This time, he sprayed the entire building down, firing in controlled bursts. 20 or so rounds into the magazine, the building across the street erupted in gunfire. Rapp hauled ass down the stairs as he heard bullets smacking into the building and gunfire being returned. Hurley was standing at the other end, waiting for him.
"What in hell did you just do?
I gave the big F.U. to Washington and got us a little diversion." Rapp looked up the stairs. The men were gone. "Come on, let's get the hell out of here." They climbed up the stairs, and when they reached the landing, a heavy-set guy in green fatigues came running down from the floor above and started ordering them to the upper floors to return fire. Hurley pointed out the back door with his rifle, and when the man looked in that direction, he deftly stuck a knife through his carotid artery. Blood came cascading out, pulsating through his fingers. Hurley followed Rapp out the back door just as a sedan skidded to a stop between two piles of rubble. The two men in the front seat jumped out of the car, yelling and asking what was going on. Rapp couldn't hear them over the gunfire, and since they weren't pointing a gun at him, he wasn't in any rush to kill them. All he wanted was their car. Two more men exited the rear of the car, one Caucasian and the other Middle Eastern. Both looked vaguely familiar, which made Rapp think he'd seen them in some of the photos Ridley had shown him. Hurley said, "Merry fucking Christmas!" and then shot the two men in front. Rapp raised the Beretta and took aim at the fair-skinned guy on the left. Hurley yelled, "Don't kill the little commie! Crack him over the head and stuff him in the trunk! I've got the other one!" Rapp and Hurley rushed the two men, their weapons leveled. Hurley swung the butt end of his rifle and cracked Syed across the temple. As the Syrian dropped to his knees, Hurley said,
"Syed, old buddy, I can't wait to play 20 questions with you."
Epilogue. Zurich, Switzerland, 4 days later. Thomas Stansfield sat on the park bench and looked up at the Rietberg Museum. He loved Zurich. The lake, the unique pace, the beauty of the mountains, but most important, the safety it afforded a man of his profession. This city, and the small country it was part of, had managed to stay out of World War II, even with war raging just beyond its borders in every direction. And in the years after that, it had continued to offer respite for cold warriors like himself and the man he was about to meet, a place where they could lower their guard, not completely, but enough to enjoy life a little, and occasionally meet face to face to discuss mutually beneficial opportunities or, in this instance, conclude vital transactions. Stansfield saw the two black sedans enter the park and glanced at his watch. The meeting would start on time, which was a nice surprise. The man he was meeting was notoriously late. Stansfield watched the sedans stop 30 feet behind the two vehicles in his entourage. Every detail had been agreed to in advance, so as to not make either party unduly skittish. Two men in dark overcoats and sunglasses exited the first car. They looked like Eastern European versions of the two men who were standing a respectful 30 feet behind the CIA's deputy director of operations. A man with unusually large ears and puffy eyes exited the second car and buttoned his blue double-breasted suit coat. One of the men approached with a wool overcoat, but the older man waved him off, which brought the hint of a smile to Stansfield's face. He had spent 6 years in Moscow. To a Russian, 40 degrees in Zurich this time of year would feel like summer. Yevgeny Primakov motioned for his men to stay by the car and walked over to the bench. Stansfield didn't stand, and Primakov didn't expect him to. Neither were handshakes offered. These were two men whose entire jobs revolved around seeing through other people's deceptions. "Did you bring my man?" Stansfield asked.
"Yes. Did you bring mine?"
"That was not part of the agreement."
"It should have been," Primakov said gruffly.
"There would have been a slight problem there, Yevgeny."
"What?"
Stansfield turned so he could face him. "My man wants to come back to America."
"Your man?" Stansfield shook his head. "He doesn't want to go back to Russia."
"What does that tell you?"
"How can I know that? You have not allowed me to talk to him."
Stansfield pulled a manila envelope from inside his jacket. "I gave you the highlights on the phone. His boss, one of your deputies, has stolen more than $20 million from Mother Russia and her fine citizens. That money is currently sitting in various accounts around the world. How do you think Deputy Shvets would be treated if I were to hand him over to you?"
Primakov did not answer the question. "Yevgeny, you do realize I could have given this to the White House. They would have shared it with your president when the time was right, and you would have been put under suspicion along with that thug Ivanov."
Primakov couldn't bring himself to say thank you, so he asked, "Why the courtesy?"
"Because I don't like my people being kidnapped and treated like a science experiment."
"You did bring Mr. Cummins?"
"Yes."
Primakov stuck out his hand for the envelope.
"Not until I see my man."
Primakov motioned to his men, and they opened the back door of the first car. The bodyguard had to help Cummins out of the sedan. He was incredibly thin, but it was him. Stansfield looked over his shoulder and snapped his fingers. One of his bodyguards took off at a trot to help with the transfer.
"The package."
Stansfield handed it to Primakov, who immediately tore it open. He flipped through the 20-odd pages and asked,
"How do I know this isn't all made up?"
"Check it yourself. The access codes are all there. The money is still in the accounts, although, trust me, I thought about using it for a few of our more creative programs." Primakov considered that for a moment. He finally managed to say,
"Thank you."
"You're welcome," Stansfield said as he stood.
"Just do me a favor, Yevgeny. Let's stick to the old rules. You stay away from my guys, and I'll stay away from yours."
Stansfield walked away with his other bodyguard close behind. He stopped at the first sedan to check on the schnoz, and then got into the back seat of the second car. The bodyguard closed the door and then went around the other side and climbed in the back seat. As soon as they were out of the park, the bodyguard took off his sunglasses and asked,
"Did he buy it, sir?"
Stansfield looked over at Mitch Rapp and said,
100%.
Rapp looked out the window, thinking that Hurley had truly lived up to his reputation as the biggest SOB on the block. It had been pure evil genius to pay Ivanov's money back into his accounts and have Shvets inform on him. "So what's going to happen to Ivanov?" Stansfield looked down and straightened his tie. "I think Mikhail Ivanov is going to spend the next few months being thoroughly interrogated by the SVR's goon squad."
"And then what?"
"He won't be able to deny the money, will he?"
"No."
Stansfield nodded. "You're a smart kid. Fill in the blanks."
"Couldn't happen to a nicer guy."
Rapp shrugged, as if he didn't care. "What about Syed?"
"Some questions are better off not asked."
Rapp frowned, He didn't like not knowing. "Listen," Sansfield said, "I can't release a guy like Syed. He'll just go back and torture more of our people." Sansfield shook his head. "The man will get what he deserves." "Sir, I hope you know. I don't give a crap what happens to him."
"Good.
What about Svets?"
"Svets will be fine as long as he continues to cooperate. In a few years we'll cut him loose and let him start a life of his own."
They drove in silence for a while, and then Rapp finally asked, "Sir, why did you want me to come along for this? Being your bodyguard is not exactly my area of expertise." Stansfield had been wondering when the rookie was going to get around to asking the question. He grinned to himself and asked Rapp, "You think Stan Hurley is a son of a bitch?"
"The biggest one I've ever met, sir."
Stansfield laughed.
"Now you know he's not big on compliments."
Rapp nodded.
"Well, he had some pretty amazing things to say about you when you got back from Beirut.
Ridley as well. Irene has been telling me for close to 2 years that she thought you might have the goods, and I guess you proved to all of us last week that you most certainly do."
"Thank you, sir."
"So I guess I wanted to have a closer look at you and show you that despite what you may have thought in Beirut, I will go to great lengths to get my people back."
Rapp nodded. He supposed Ridley had passed on his blistering critique.
"I know that now, sir."
"Good. Now I think you should take a week off. You've earned it. I don't care where you go as long as it's west of here. 7 days from now, report to Stan. I've got something else I want you to work on."
Rapp was tempted to ask, but decided he didn't want it weighing on him while he was trying to recharge.
"Any idea where you're going to go?" Stansfield asked. "In case we need to get hold of you?"
Rapp looked at the snow-capped mountains and thought of Greta. With a smile on his face, he said, "I think I'm going to stay right here in Zurich."
American Assassin was written by Vince Flynn and read by George Guidel. Post-production by Common Mode, Paul Fowley, technical director. The mix engineer was Terry Hogan. The associate producer was Christina Zarafanidis. American Assassin was directed by Megan Barrickman and produced by David Markowitz at the Studios of Recorded Books, LLC. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio.